From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we discussed Tuesday's midterm elections with Professor Tony Montero. We spoke with him live via Skype from Philadelphia Thursday. Not really a blue wave for sure. I'm looking at the historical data, and it's less than typical for the midterms in the first year of a new president. And the Republicans increased their lead in the Senate. We're still waiting for a couple of races to be determined for sure, but they have an absolute majority. That's guaranteed.
Right, right. Yes, and I would say, Don, that what we're looking at, and this is a positive, is that politics writ large have broken out. We have, for many people, entered into a moment of political hell, where rather than strategic compromise and so-called consensus building, there's real political struggle afoot in the country. And interestingly enough, if you look at things outside of the brainwashing narrative of the corporate media, the thing that arose as a central factor in this election is class, the specter of class. And they talked about it by trying to obscure it by always saying that Trump's base are white men who don't have college degrees.
Right.
And who have lost everything or most everything in this rush to globalize the world economy. So we're looking at class. And I would say another thing is that what is appealing about Trump to what they call his base is that he is the anti-president president, the anti-elite president, the anti-elite media president. And that has a lot of appeal. In fact, I would even argue that for many people, including myself, it is aesthetically appealing. You know, a lot of people say, well, aesthetically, Trump is not presidential, or aesthetically, Trump looks like what we think a fascist should look like. But to me, there is something very appealing about what is breaking out in the country, including the press conference that Trump held yesterday, where he, you know, said that he and Pelosi could come to an agreement. And this is what was so interesting. He would rather have a Democratic majority in the House than to have a Republican majority where he only had a majority of two or three, because he felt that he could work with Pelosi and they could come to agreements on things such as climate change, the healthcare system, the cost of pharmaceutical drugs, and on and on and on. I think we've entered a very profound period of politics, and too few of us fully recognize what is going on. It was not a defeat for Trump. It was a partial victory for the Democrats. The Democrats will not be able to unite in the House of Representatives. There are those who want to go for impeachment investigation, and there are people who are practical, like Nancy Pelosi and maybe Elijah Cummings and maybe some other of the older guard, who realize that if they overplay their hand, the chance of Trump being reelected are higher. But the most important thing is that while the Democrats won, the Democrats are probably the most disunited party that has power in the House of Representatives in our memory.
Yeah. You know, that press conference yesterday, there was something that caught my attention also, that little scuffle with Acosta from CNN.
Yeah.
And, you know, the attraction that you're talking about, seeing Trump mix it up with some of these people that represent the elite. I remember a press conference 2 years ago with Acosta in Havana, where he arrogantly started, you know, the same kind of questioning of Raul Castro over human rights. And he starts with, in broken Spanish, you know, my father was an exile from Cuba. Which tells me, looking at him, chances are his father worked for Batista.
Right, but, absolutely.
You know, okay. Mm-hmm. And then he starts running down, you know, Cuba, political prisoners, and all of this. So he asks the question of the two of them, and he also asks, he tags it with, you know, Mr. Castro, President Castro, do you favor Trump or Clinton, Hillary Clinton, in the election that was pending in 2016? And Castro said to that, I don't vote in the United States. That was his answer. But he served it up to Obama. Mm-hmm. In a way that basically was giving Obama an opportunity to challenge his host on human rights. And the idea of an American president lecturing anyone in the Western Hemisphere on human rights is particular, from Havana, no less. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even think irony fits it. But this is the same guy. When I saw that press conference then, I was like, I wish I were in Havana right now so I could smack this guy in the back of his head. How dare he? Mm-hmm. And yet, yesterday, we watched Trump do it. For me,
yeah.
I was doing it vicariously through him over what he did in Havana. And yet, absolutely, they're painting this as fascism.
Well, I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that we don't have a free press. The free press is the press on the margins, like what you do, like what Black Agenda does, what Truth Out, Truth Dig, Real News Network, and Global Research, places like that do.
Well, you can tell what's a free press on payday. On payday,
yeah,
our
absolutely.
Free press gets paid for free.
That's right. But it is not free from the interest of the deep state.
Right, that's right.
And the 1%. And guys like Acosta or Don Lemon or Anderson Cooper or Rachel Maddow, they are paid handsomely because they serve the most powerful economic, political interest in the country. And I would dare say those who represent this ruthless dictatorship over the masses of people in this country. And that is why Donald Trump's pushback and challenge to Acosta and his hangers-on was of such great significance. The corporate media has to be taken on at every opportunity. And thus, new space is opened up for thought, and really for class politics.
Right.
For class politics. And this is why how we understand the question of race and white supremacy is so very, very important. You know, you get all of these so-called liberal black and white politicians, most of whom are super rich, invoking race. But for them, race is but a trope for identity. They're talking about not the politics of racial liberation or
right.
black liberation.
Right.
They're talking about identity politics.
Right.
And far be it from any of them to even think about linking the question of race and black liberation to the liberation of the black working class and of the right. working class as a whole.
Right.
And so this blithe way that they throw around the question of white supremacy and homophobia and xenophobia. This is the language of the petty bourgeoisie,
right,
who can only imagine liberation as freedom for themselves. That's why they call it the Me Too movement and not the We Too movement.
That's right.
It's me first, me only, and me.
Right.
It's me.
It's atomic.
And that's the politics historically of the petty bourgeoisie,
right,
especially the petty bourgeoisie in a moment of crisis.
That's right. Atomized. I mean, and that's exactly how the bourgeoisie wants the rest of the society, is atomized.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well,
on the other side, you get this rising class development. It's not like people imagined it. It's not like maybe we would all want it. It doesn't have the aesthetics of a documentary of the Chinese Revolution or the Cuban Revolution,
right,
but it's the way it's going to come. The logic is there. You got two sides, the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats are the party of the 1% and the deep state and the military. What we have in the Republican Party, which is the Trump Party increasingly, is the coming to the fore of interests that are more in alignment with that of working people. And that is what is being fought against by the Democrats. Now, the good thing is that the Democrats are a fractured, divided party that has nothing to hold it together, and they will fight each other more than they'll fight Trump within the next year.
You know, you've got a couple of things I want to parse out of that. I guess most immediately, some of the institutional characters in the Republican Party suddenly discovered over the last few weeks up through Tuesday that either they're with Trump or they're on the curb.
That's right.
Look at Ted Cruz, for example, who would have nothing to do with Trump before and who would be unemployed now, and, you know, back to ambulance chasing if it weren't for Trump coming to rally there. Several other notables over the course of the campaign, and those that Trump turned his cold shoulder to are out, like Flake and et cetera. So there's that, this part of the calculus. But I want to go first to this, which is in terms of looking at how people refuse to look at the working class, politics that are involved heavily in all of this, definitely fail to look at the international working class.
Right.
Because if you're going to talk about white supremacy at an international working class, for example, then what do you call AFRICOM that was installed in Africa by America's quote-unquote first black president?
Absolutely.
That to me, the working class politics of it are, we surrendered a continent of the strongest, most forward-based part of the working class to the Pentagon.
Yeah. I mean, and what do you call the brutal war on Libya and the vicious assassination of its leader, Muammar Gaddafi?
Right.
Was that not a racist act?
Right.
People say, well, he was an Arab. Well, don't Arabs, and have they not historically suffered from Western colonialism and racism?
Yeah.
Well, this is why I'm saying the struggle against racism as presented by the representatives of the Democratic Party and the so-called liberal academics is not really a struggle for freedom. It's a struggle for the individual to be free, not for humanity to be free, because they're very comfortable with U.S. imperialism, with the war on Africa, with the wars in the Middle East. They hardly raised any protest. And so we have to look not only at the subjective side of racism, in other words, as an individual, I experience racism because of the color of my skin. Okay, you do. But then let's look at the objective side as well. What is racism? What is the institutions and structures of racism? And how do we liberate the masses of people from the institutions of oppression They will never be, the masses will never be integrated as into the system as probably a Van Jones or a Barack Obama or a Andrew Gillum or whatever. They will never be integrated, and they're never intended to be integrated. So we're talking about a project of upward mobility into the ruling class of the black petty bourgeoisie, and not a program of the liberation of the masses. And this is where their talk of white supremacy and race becomes so distasteful and is done in such utter bad faith. And I include among those who have hoodwinked the masses of people by showing them a shiny object that's supposed to represent black liberation. I include among them, and at the top of the list, the Oprah Winfreys and the Barack Obamas, who are not part of the great and historic struggle of black folk that is defined by what we call the black radical tradition. They are traitors to the masses of people, and they operate in the interest of the enemies, the class enemies of the vast majority of black working and poor people.
You know, one of the things that I found extremely ironic about Oprah Winfrey interjecting herself into the campaign in Georgia for Abrams was the absolute absence of Oprah Winfrey anywhere in the attack on Cynthia McKinney that was rolled out over several years.
Yeah.
When Cynthia McKinney was the only voice, for example, in the Congress and among the black leadership in the Congress and mostly throughout the country, standing up for people in New Orleans, for example. Probably the only person in Congress ever to put Rumsfeld on the stand and say, where's the missing $1 trillion? She gets run out of Congress over that, and Oprah Winfrey did not come to Georgia at that time or utter a word about it.
No. No. Nor will you find Oprah Winfrey raising her eloquence against police murders of young black men and women throughout the United States.
Right, or AFRICOM. Did she mention AFRICOM?
Oh, I haven't heard that either. No,
right, okay.
Nor did she oppose the wars in Iraq, Syria, right. Afghanistan, Libya.
Right.
So her talk of, you know, people fought so you would have the right to vote. Well, people fought so that we African Americans, at least on paper, would have equality. That was in the mid-20th century. Now, the struggle of the 21st century is that the substance of equality, which means economic, political, and social equality, right, are achieved. And that means structural changes, right, in the society.
Right. You have a society, actually, that has been developing in exactly the opposite direction for everyone, for the masses, mm-hmm, of people. And the only equality that has been under development is the equality of destitution.
Right. The equality of poverty. Yes.
Right.
Yes. And we see it. And in some of these polls, which are showing, and I think this is a profound development, that upwards of 40% of black people favor Trump's policies. A lot of people, especially on the two coasts, would ask, well, where are these black people? I've not met a black person that has expressed any inclination towards Trump. Well, they live in places like Detroit, in Cleveland, in Akron, in St. Louis, right, these heavily deindustrialized areas of the Midwest, you know? And I think there are black people who don't say it out loud.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of times whose voices are not given any weight, who say in privacy or even to a pollster, that I find his honesty refreshing. I find the fact that he is unscripted refreshing. I find the fact that he is seeking detente with Russia and North Korea, that something is going on here that could mean something positive for people like myself. That is what we're getting in the thinking of Black people. They're not going to be on television. They're not going to be interviewed. In fact, the only time I've seen Richard Trumka interviewed on anything close to the corporate media was the other day on Fox. And he's the head of the AFL-CIO, and these trade deals are all about the historic opposition of the AFL-CIO towards NAFTA. But I don't hear his voice. I don't hear the voice of ordinary working people. I don't hear the voices of Black folk, ordinary Black folk, and their opinions of what is going on. But these so-called representatives that you see on CNN and MSNBC and sometimes on Fox and so on, this is what this is supposed to be the voice of the Black masses. And I'm telling you, it's not. They're two different ideological developments here. In fact, I would dare say that something looking like a class and ideological conflict is developing within the ranks of Black folk right now.
I would say also within the ranks of the working class in general in the United States.
I agree with you.
Because the other game that you have going on is symbolized by the political parties, but you know, since the historical development of politics, of retail politics in the United States, leaves us with a situation of the Republican Party having been becoming the white man's party, the white people's party, as Glenn Ford calls it, the party of white supremacy, taking the place of the Democratic Party, which played that role from the beginning of the United States, more or less, since the founding of the Democratic Party. All the way up until, say, 1968, I guess, is probably where Nixon's Southern strategy first really took hold. And I guess Goldwater was leaning that way and working it. But in 1964, you still had what happened in Atlantic City happen inside the Democratic Party. So I'd say from 1790, 1789, 1790 until 1968, the Democratic Party was the party of white supremacy. Of Lester Maddox, of you know, all of those guys, George Wallace, and on and on and on, and some much uglier ones, as a matter of fact, years before. So we come to the party dressed in the clothes that we have. You have the white working class having lifted Trump up inside the Republican Party, and you had had other parts of the working class, including parts of the white working class, the millennials, inside the Democratic Party, trying to lift Sanders up while the Clintonites were shooting at them. But that phenomenon comes out of the actual condition of the working class, and that shared condition militates towards class unity, but the retail politics is actually dragging it in another direction, and that's a problem to solve.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, you know, unless our lenses are sharpened through an understanding of class and how race and the Black liberation struggle and the class conflict potentially overlap and intersect, unless we have a vision that also sees that Black people, Black workers, are the principal victims and the first victims of the neoliberal reorganization of the global economy, the first victims, and how now you see this rebellion among white working people, among white farmers, that might not yet see the Black worker and the commonality there. But we who claim leadership, who claim to know, who claim science, have to say that if this logic continues, if it is not interrupted, if it is not repressed, that something new in the politics of this country is being born. And whether it comes through a Trump presidency or whether it comes through other forms of rebellion, so be it. But the question is, from a scientific standpoint, from a materialist point of view, what is going on and what is emerging? You know, Engels had this concept, the negation of a negation. You know what I'm saying? If the Republican Party became the white man's party after Nixon, let us say, then, and it was a negation of the previous Republican kind of stand of Eisenhower and what came before that, going back to Lincoln. If the Southern strategy was a negation of that, then is this not a negation of the Southern strategy, of the white man's party strategy? And this is what I think is emerging.
Yeah, I mean, we saw firsthand at the RNC, contrary to our expectations of people wanting to, you know, they were fighting over abortion and gay marriage and all of that, looking at Trump, and we saw this during the campaign leading up to the RNC, and saying, yeah, maybe I voted over that stuff before. I don't care about abortion. I don't care about gay marriage. I don't care about any of this other stuff. That guy's going to get me a job. That's what I care about. And there was a sense there, those people understood what was happening with the people lifting up Sanders. They were a lot more willing to take a look across the aisle at the people that were lifting up Sanders and seeing a commonality of interest being expressed there than the people at the DNC were to look back at the RNC and say, you know, now, there are historical reasons for this that I understand. If I'm getting my butt kicked my whole life for my skin color, for example, and a guy in exactly my condition is, you know, getting driven around in a limo over his skin color, when he comes to talk to me, say, let's forget the skin color thing, I'm going to be looking at him a little funny. But when I see that neither of us are going to go anywhere unless we work that problem out, that's another matter.
Well, and that's what's going on. And I would say, I think I mentioned this to you before in one of our interviews, that in a lot of ways, this election was about the two sides in a profound and historic ideological conflict. The question of the elites versus the masses. Now, of course, in 2 years, I don't know what Trump has delivered. Right. Materially to the working class, or they claim something from tax cuts. But I think the big question was a referendum on a rebellion against the ruling elites. That's what 2018 was about.
Right.
And it was, in all indications, it was a standoff.
Right.
We're pretty much where we were after the election of 2016,
right.
Nothing fundamentally changed.
Which is pretty amazing given the media campaign that's taken place uninterrupted for 2 years.
No question.
You know, I remember in 2004 when it looked like Howard Dean was going to be a shoo-in. He's on TV, he screams for 3 seconds, the media tanked him for 2 days, and he was off the scene.
Yeah.
And you know what they've done in terms of the coverage with Trump since the middle of 2015, really, but certainly since the spring of 2016, and he hasn't gone down in the polls at all, really. He hasn't been injured by it at all.
He understands what Howard Dean did not understand. He understands the media.
Right.
He understands the players, the structure, how they function. And so, and he also understands that the media, which is driven by profit, cannot sustain anything for so long. So any story only has a short shelf life, maybe of a few hours, and then it moves on to something else. So he understands that. He understands how to play the media, and he's not intimidated by the media. And that's a great advantage in this struggle.
I think that we're going to have to take a look at what develops in the media next, the next media narrative next week. We appreciate your time, Tony. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.